Welcome, everybody, to this is the State Government Finance and Elections Committee meeting for February 14th, 2022. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting is being held virtually. The committee assistant will take the roll.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Nelson.
I'm present.
Chair Nelson is present. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson's present.
Vice Chair Carlson is present. Representative Nash.
Nash present.
Nash is present. Representative Bonner. Representative Drazkowski.
Present.
Representative Drazkowski is present. Representative Elkins.
Elkins present.
Elkins is present. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Greenman is present. Representative Cleborne.
Cleborne present.
Representative Cleborne is present. Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Kosnick is present. Representative Mason.
Mason present.
Mason is present. Representative New Brindley. Representative Pulowski.
Pulowski present.
Pulowski is present. Representative Quam.
Present.
Quam is present. Representative Bonner.
Present.
Bonner is present. Representative New Brindley. With that, Chair, we have a quorum.
We have a quorum. Representative Nash texted me and wants to have a say something. So, Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Last week at the end of our meeting, I had made a motion to lay a bill on the table and time expired. And after that, I may have chortled a little bit too inappropriately, and I just wanted to apologize to the committee for doing so. That wasn't a behavior that I think that I should have taken, so my apologies to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Nash. With that, members, Representative Cleborne, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I move the minutes to adopt the amendments. Thank you.
Representative Cleborne moves to approve the minutes for February 11th, 2022. All in favor, unmute and say aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes are approved. And now, members, with that, we've got an aggressive agenda that we have bills that we have to get done. And just going to remind people that in the past, we have set time certain to vote on that, on these bills. I'm going to do that and start doing that again with this meeting. And the first bill we're going to take is House File 3091. I want to vote on that by 11 o'clock. The bill after that is House File, or excuse me, my bill is House File 3091. And we'll vote on that by 11. Then we have Wolgamott's House File 3021. And I hope to vote on that by 11:30. And then give 15 minutes for the department or for the governor's staff to do their supplementary budget request that they didn't get to last week. And then we've also have an update for CGIP, MMB, the PBM reverse auction that we voted out last year, the progress on that. And remember, members, we're going to be recessing at noon for floor session, coming back 30 minutes after session ends, but no sooner than 4:30 p.m. tonight. And tonight, when you come back, use the same link, Zoom link, to get back in the committee hearing. And we have a couple bills that we'll be taking up afterwards at that. So, members, with that, I will hand the gavel over to Representative Carlson and House File 3091.
Going to take it off the table?
Take it off the table, yes. I'll move to take it off the table or bring it before the committee.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Nelson. We made some pretty good headway in this last week with testifiers. I see we have a few additional testifiers. So, Chair Nelson, if you don't mind, I think we'll get to those folks first and then get to the amendments. How's that sound?
That sounds good to me.
All right, let's do this. I've got Commissioner Roberts Davis. You're up first.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Alice Roberts Davis. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Administration. Thank you for hearing House File 3091 again this morning. As a reminder, this is Edmonds Policy and Technical Change Bill, and I'll give you a very brief recap. First, we are completing the final two cleanup items from the move of the State Historic Preservation Office to admin from the Minnesota Historical Society. Next, we have a couple of proposals to streamline the State Designer Selection Board's work, including clarifying which projects need review and increasing the threshold for contracts that come before the board. We are proposing to increase them to $400,000 in design fees and $4 million in construction costs and set a regular schedule for adjustment reviews. The threshold has not been updated since its establishment in 1996, and so this will allow for higher threshold projects to be heard by the State Designer Selection Board. We are also proposing an exemption for consultants from state construction delays so that construction work does not need to be further delayed until all of the paperwork can catch up. This brings parity with contractor changes, which are currently exempt from construction delays. Additionally, we'd like to add design and construction projects to the contracts that are eligible to waive the procurement process during emergencies. And finally, we're looking to correct our statutes to reflect the move of the Office of Collaboration and Dispute Resolution to admin back in 2019. This concludes my really brief testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. I also have members of my team here if there are questions that they can assist me with.
Thank you, Commissioner. Appreciate the brevity. I also have for the next testifier, Wayne Wozlowski. Wayne, if you want to introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, Mr. Chair. For the record, Wayne Wozlowski with the Department of Administration, and I'm just available to answer any questions.
Perfect.
So don't have to prepare testimony.
Okay, that's kind of what I figured, but I saw your name on the list, so I didn't want to assume anything. But thanks for being with us here today. Okay, folks, that concludes our testifiers for today. We do have three amendments, so let's get moving on those. I have an A1 amendment. Representative Quam, would you like to move your amendment?
I would so move.
Okay, Representative Quam moves the A1 amendment. Representative Quam, to your amendment. Oh, I'm sorry. All those in favor of moving the A1 amendment, say aye.
Mr. Chair, first we need to explain the amendment.
Oh, sorry. See, when we get these tight timelines, I'm quick to want to move to that vote. Sorry, everybody.
Thank you,
Representative
Mr. Chair.
Quam, to your amendment.
I believe this is the one that brings mediation back into the bill.
Representative Quam, I have the amendment in front of me.
And I'm trying to, it's not opening for me.
Okay. It's relatively short. Moves to amend House File 3091 as follows. Page 9, line 2, reinstate mediation and delete consultation.
And then, right. There's
page 9, lines 16 and 17, reinstate the stricken language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it's pretty simple. There's a difference between mediation and consultation. Adding consultation could be done in a more accurate manner, but with many meetings with union personnel, there is a resistance to deleting the word mediation out of our legislation. And there's, because of the difference between consulting and mediation, I feel it's wrong to delete out the word mediation, from a bill, because I think mediation is a process that should be included and maintained to be included in legislation. This is more of a general statement. When you consult somebody, they can talk to you and you can ignore them. But mediation has been a process utilized across many aspects of our state and government. And so this is more of a principle that we should not be deleting mediation out of bills. Adding in a consultation portion would be preferable. And that is why I brought this this amendment forward.
Okay. Chair Nelson, to the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I think this is part of the piece of the bill that's cleaning up the movement of the State Historic Preservation Office to the Historical Society. Mr. Wentworth, I think, is here. He can answer maybe, or maybe Ms. Roberts Davis could answer why the amendment is inappropriate. And I'll take it from there, but I oppose the amendment as it is.
Okay. Does anybody else wish to speak to the A1 amendment?
I see Ms. Byerly has her hand up, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Byerly, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you look at the section of statute that we're proposing to change, it currently has a title of mediation, and we're proposing to change it to consultation. When you look at the statute, the beginning portion of the statute discusses how the State Historic Preservation Office, how local entities and state agencies need to consult with the State Preservation Office on preservation and how any construction projects may impact the historic preservation of those sites listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Later in the statute, it does discuss a mediation task force if the parties cannot come to an agreement in that consultation. So that is why we're proposing to change it to consultation. We would be open to perhaps putting both words in, so putting consultation first, semicolon, then mediation, to really accurately describe that section. So we would be open to that oral amendment. But we would like to keep the rest. So the other part of the amendment also discusses keeping the current language, which limits who the Historical Society can appoint to the mediation task force. So currently, state has a lot of representation on that from the governor, the State Historic Preservation Office, and the Commissioner of Administration. So there's no representation from the Historical Society there. We would propose that perhaps the director of the Historical Society could appoint an employee. There is still a requirement that whoever the director's appointee would have to have the technical expertise for the issue at hand.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Farrell.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Nelson, yes.
Thank you. I would suggest then, I oppose this amendment as written. I would say we vote this down, and then we can do the oral amendment that was suggested by the assistant commissioner. And she didn't identify her name for the tape, but that's okay. We all do that from time to time. But Mr. Chair, I would propose that we vote this down, and then we can do that oral amendment.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion to the A1 amendment, if members could please unmute themselves. And then all those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. No. The moment. The amendment does not pass and is not adopted. I think before we get to any oral amendment changes, let's get through the other two we have listed for the day. I have the A2 amendment. If the member that is offering the A2 could please identify themselves.
Mr. Chair, that would be Representative Nash.
Representative Nash, if you would please proceed with describing the A2 amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the A2 amendment and request a roll call.
Roll call being requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to revert the policy back to what is in statute currently on the thresholds for the $4 million to $400,000, which is requested, and move that back to $2 million and $200,000 for the review process for the projects. And for the simple reason of this, I've spoken to a lot of people around the state, and there are times that folks who put money into our coffers, and that comes only through one way, that comes through taxes, that they believe that there should be a significant amount of scrutiny and that things should not just be rubber stamped and moved along their way. As a result of that, this amendment would keep the policy the way it is, simply because we want to be able to say that the spending that we've done has been reviewed and has been looked at, and I just think that that's probably the most prudent thing that we can do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mash. And I don't see any other hands
Mr. Chair.
Raised. Yes, Chair Nelson, to you on the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, like I said, this is an administration bill, but I oppose the amendment. I think that there's a sound sense for raising the amount when we have to involve the consultation from the designer.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Seeing no further discussion, a roll call has been requested. If the committee assistant would please take the roll.
Thank you. Chair Nelson?
No.
Chair Nelson votes no. Vice Chair Carlson?
Carlson, no.
Carlson, no. Representative Nash?
Nash votes aye.
Nash votes aye. Representative Bonner?
Bonner votes nay.
Bonner votes nay. Representative Drazkowski?
Aye.
Drazkowski votes aye. Representative Elkins?
Elkins votes no.
Elkins votes nay. Representative Greenman?
No.
Greenman votes nay. Representative Cleborne?
No.
Cleborne votes nay. Representative Kosnick?
Aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason?
Mason, no.
Mason votes no. Representative New Brindley?
Yes.
New Brindley votes aye. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, no.
Pawlowski votes no. Representative Quam?
Aye.
Quam votes aye. With 5 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail.
Thank you. The third amendment, we have Representative Nash, are you going to take this one too?
Mr. Chair, I believe Representative Kosnick has that.
Representative Kosnick, there you are. Okay. Representative Kosnick, you've got the A3 amendment. Would you like to move your amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move the A3 amendment.
Wonderful. Please proceed with describing your amendment.
Thank you. Members, the current statute allows during emergency powers that in emergencies the commissioner may make any purchases that are necessary for the repair, rehabilitation, and improvement of state-owned structures. The amendment keeps the current language because I think we have shown in the recent emergency powers that we would end up creating situations where the administration would probably overstep their powers and possibly commit the state to additional ongoing maintenance by allowing construction for new facilities that I don't think are necessary even during emergency times. And the most recent emergency periods have shown that to be true.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative Kosnick. I do see Chair Nelson has his hand up. Before we get to the chair to speak to the amendment, does anybody else have any comments to the A3 amendment? Okay, Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Matt.
Representative Nash, I'm sorry.
It's okay, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the Kosnick amendment, I agree that we have seen a number of things that were purchased during the emergency that I'm very confident people across the state of Minnesota did not agree with, and in retrospect wound up not being used. We'll just throw out the morgue that has now been moved on to a new owner. But there's a need for oversight, and I think that the people of the state of Minnesota would like to see that oversight being exercised even in a state of emergency. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Chair Nelson, back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, It's my understanding of this, and I think this was explained last week when we had this originally in front of us, but my understanding with this is that this goes back to when we had the bird flu emergency, where the state didn't have the capacity to do testing, and they were looking to build a lab to do that testing with the bird flu emergency, but because of the way the current statute, they weren't able to do that. And that's what this is basically looking to fix, is that issue there. And as to the morgue that was purchased and now sold, that the state actually made money when they sold it. They got more money back than they paid for it. So members, this is a good change. Just like I said, this is to allow for unforeseen things that happen, that to be able to move quickly, like I said, in the bird flu epidemic that we had, to try and protect, you know, they wanted to build a lab, but in situations like that, to be able to move quickly to do what they need to do to stop the emergency.
Okay. Representative Kosnick, I see you have raised your hand. I'm assuming you would like to have some final thoughts on the A3 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I do have some final thoughts, but I also have an additional question pertinent to the amendment in this section of the bill.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, or perhaps the administration, if not the author, could explain more than just the ability to construct that's listed in here. There is also providing a difference from state-owned property to now it's going to be public-owned property. And why is it important and necessary to include Minnesota State Colleges and Universities in this section of law for emergency acquisitions?
Okay. Someone from the department. Is there someone from the department available?
I believe
to
Mr. Wozlowski. That is.
Yes. Mr. Wozlowski, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Wayne Wozlowski, Director for Real Estate and Construction Services with ADMIN. In the avian flu situation in 2015 timeframe, U of M actually was appropriated the funds to construct the facility, so that in that emergency, they were working through the U of M. The U of M also has to go through the State Designer Selection Board, as does Minnesota State, and so it was that same issue that prevented that from happening in an expeditious manner. And again, there was significant economic hardship that was happening at the time in the 60 to 90 day delay that resulted had significant economic impact.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that addresses the issues for the state colleges and universities, but I'm still remain to have concerns about publicly owned structures that would also be publicly owned, but not within the university system. There are a variety of other publicly owned or quasi publicly owned entities that would cause concern that I think that's a little too broad. We could talk about sports facilities and such as that, but I just don't think it's necessary.
Okay. Representative Kosnick, would you like to make some closing remarks on the amendment, or?
I believe a couple other members have their hand up, Mr. Chair.
So you gotta keep clicking through the pages here. Yes. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't believe any of the state government committee members, except for me, serve on the Agriculture Committee. But we have recently had testimony from the Board of Animal Health concerning potential viruses that could harm our, I think it was the turkey industry in particular. And so this language, while we might think that it's based on old history, it might be something that we would need definitely going forward. So I just want to make sure that the committee is aware that there are other pathogens out there that we need to be concerned about going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Nash, are you still speaking on this, or is that just a hangover?
Mr. Chair, very quickly.
Right, go for it.
I was in office, as was Representative Kosnick and many of the rest of us, during the avian flu outbreak. We met every day. Every single day. This was not something that could not have been addressed and was not addressed by the legislature. We were appropriating money and fighting the flu every single day. So once again, I think that that example is a fairly weak one. And this is not something that I think is an outrageous request for us to be able to offer some oversight. Thank you.
Okay, members, just to give you a time check, we have 5 minutes left to spend on this bill. I'm going to give Representative Koznick 20 seconds to wrap it up, and then we're going to go to a vote on the A3 amendment. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I think this particular amendment is a very good amendment because it preserves the role of the legislature, even in emergency times. Representative Nash gave a great example. The legislature was in session and actively managing the previous avian flu situation, but we need to continue to protect the role of the legislature and have checks and balances against the administration. We saw recently the abuses of emergency powers. I hope maybe this committee can do some reforms of that. But what this amendment does is preserves the role of the legislature and the checks and balances. And I think it's a very recent example of the pandemic that we're in, of why we need to have the legislature be in control and preserve our constitutional rights instead of handing over our authority to the administration. And the current ability for the administration to do repairs, rehabilitation, and improvements are sufficient. And I'm not sure that I know our constituents and mine do not want to enhance the emergency powers of the administration. So this is a valid, serious amendment, and I hope it's well taken, members.
Members, if you would please unmute yourself, and we'll call for a vote. All those in favor of the A3 amendment say aye.
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 All those opposed say no.
No.
The amendment does not pass and was not adopted. Chair Nelson, there was some discussion about an oral amendment. Do we have some framing around that yet, some language? I want to keep us on task here, so I don't want to get us bogged down.
Mr. Chair?
1 second, Representative Quam. I'm talking with Chair Nelson at the moment.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And maybe Mr. Gehring can help me with this if I say it wrong, but I believe the amendment would be on line 9.2. Reinstate the stricken language mediation and put a semicolon between mediation and consultation, and that would be the amendment. But I'll ask Mr. Gehring to verify that. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, yeah, that's correct. So there'd be line 9.2, reinstate stricken mediation and insert a semicolon.
All right. Does that require repeating before we take this? Okay, I see some heads nodding. Let's see. Chair Nelson, I'm going to deem this your oral amendment. If you could, for the record, restate your amendment, please.
Mr. Chair, members, I move that to amend the bill on page 9.2 to reinstate the stricken language mediation and add a semicolon at the end of mediation.
Okay. Questions to the oral amendment? Seeing no hands.
I think Mr. Representative Quam.
Oh, yes. Representative Quam, was your question with regards to the oral amendment?
In the moving things along, I'll address it with a clarification amendment added sometime in the future. Bye.
Thank you, Representative. Okay. Seeing no further discussion, members, if you would please unmute yourself.
Yeah.
Chair Nelson, question?
No, I'm just
thinking out loud.
Thinking out loud, yes.
All right, members. All those in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. The amendment passes and the amendment is adopted. All right, back to the bill as a whole. Discussion to the House File 3091. Okay, and I am scanning so I don't miss anybody. Okay, seeing no further discussion. Chair Nelson, would you like to re-renew your motion to refer House File 3091 as amended to the General Register?
Mr. Chair, I'll renew my motion that House 3091 as amended be referred to the General Register.
Excellent. Will the legislative assistant please take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
Nash votes no.
Nash votes nay. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Drozdowski.
No.
Drozdowski votes no. Representative Elkins.
Elkins votes yes.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne, aye.
Cleburne votes aye. Representative Kosmic.
Kosmic, no.
Kosmic votes nay. Representative Mason.
Mason, aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley.
No.
New Brindley votes nay. Representative Pulowski.
Pulowski, aye.
Pulowski votes aye. Representative Quam.
Aye.
Quam votes nay. With a vote of 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Brinks. Yes, so by a vote of 8 ayes and 5 nays, the House File, what do we got? House File 3091 has been approved, and it will be referred to the General Register. At this time, I will turn the gavel back to Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair Carlson. With that, members, the next bill we have on our agenda for this morning is House File 3021, Representative Wolgamott. And I'll move House File 3021 to be referred to the Committee on Higher Education. Representative Wolgamott, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to come before you today to present House File 3021, which is a bill that does two things. It codifies and expands an existing rule pertaining to student residentialness, and it clarifies and expands an existing statute pertaining to pre-voter registration. I'll address the first aspect of the bill, Mr. Chair, which again codifies and expands an existing rule pertaining to student residentialness. It codifies language saying that all post-secondary institutions that enroll students accepting state financial aid must prepare a current list of students enrolled in the institution and residing in the institution's housing. That's codifying an existing rule. We're expanding it by also saying that they will prepare and submit a list of students who live within 10 miles of the institution's campus to their county auditor for the to be certified for use in election day registration. The reason why we're doing that, Mr. Chair, is our that is going to make it so that both students who live on campus and students who live near campus are able to use their student IDs to be able to register to vote on election day. We are going to be a stronger democracy if we make sure that all of our students, both those who live on campus and who live off campus, are able to bring their voter ID to register on election day. I know from my days of being a student and in conversations with the students that I represent who attend St. Cloud State University and St. Cloud State Technical Community College, that sometimes it's difficult to, you know, sure, you signed a lease, but maybe you're subletting, or, you know, maybe you don't have a paper utility bill in your name because either you do it online or it's in your landlord's name. We already have this for students who live on campus. We now, with this legislation, will be giving this opportunity to students who live near campus. That's the first aspect of the bill. The second aspect of the bill, Mr. Chair and members, pertains to pre-registration. Our current statute says that a Minnesotan can pre-register if they will be 18 before the next election. That's a little bit unclear, Mr. Chair. Do we mean the primary election? Are we talking about the general election? It's a little bit vague, so we're clarifying and expanding it to include those who are at least 16 years of age and otherwise eligible. So again, we're changing that language to an individual who is under the age of 18, who is at least 16 years of age and otherwise eligible, may submit a voter registration application. And we do have language to be very clear, stating nothing in the section shall be construed to entitle an individual to appear on a polling place roster or cast a ballot at an election if the individual does not meet all requirements, all eligibility requirements for voting, including age. So again, we're working with just expanding what is current statute. The way this works is a student can, or a Minnesota young adult can pre-register to vote if they will be 18 before the next election. This just kind of goes in a pending status within the Secretary of State's system. And then as soon as it hits their birthday, then their registration becomes active. So again, we're not really doing anything new here. We're just clarifying existing statute and expanding it to include Minnesotans who are 16 years old and 17 years old. That way they can get registered to vote, pre-registered to vote with their family, with their kind of a more stable situation in their life, and be set up to vote when they're 18. And my hope is continue to be lifelong participants in our democracy and our voting system for the rest of their days. So there is a fiscal note on this bill, Mr. Chair. The cost is going to be $19,000 of a one-time cost for this biennium. $17,000 of that will go to the Secretary of State just for the staffing that's going to take to make these updates to the system, the forms, all that kind of staffing hours. And then there is $1,000 per year to the University of Minnesota who would like to use the GIS systems to help them with the transfer of those off-campus student addresses. So very small fiscal note, but a very big impact in making sure that our young adults are able to participate in our democratic process, to make sure that our students are able to have their voices and their intentions reflected in public policy. All of us, our whole democracy is gonna be stronger by including the voices and the votes of these young adults. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and with your permission, I do have a testifier here who will also weigh in on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And after the testimony, we'll be more than happy to answer any questions you may have about this legislation.
Thank you, Representative Wolkermont. I see on the list I have Secretary Simon as a testifier. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. I'll try to be quick because you don't have a lot of time. I don't have much time, so I can't stay with you a long time, but I want to thank Representative Wolkermont for this bill. This is a provision that's worthy of bipartisan acceptance, just as it's been nationwide. I should say that until Representative Wolkermont took the baton for a number of years, the chief author of this, including last year or the year before, was Representative Erdahl. And so given his experience as a retired social studies teacher, he felt very strongly about this bill and carried it at least since 2015. 25 states already do what Minnesota does now, which is say it says that somebody can pre-register before they're 18 in some fashion. In addition to those 25 states, 19 additional states, for a total of 19 additional states do what this bill proposes, which is to say 16 or 17 year olds can vote. And they are of various political complexions. Blue states, red states like West Virginia, Louisiana, Utah, et cetera, passed by Republican legislatures and Republican governors and Democratic legislatures and Democratic governors. And the idea here is, of course, to extend it so that we have a bright line rule. Instead of saying you have to be a certain age by an election, and Representative Wolkermont is right, one of the things that a number of us have tried to clarify for some time is that our current statute isn't as tightly written as it should be. It says next election. It doesn't say next general election, leading to some confusion and even some hesitancy on the part of young people who don't want to run afoul of the law, which is a good impulse. But I think what the legislature meant once upon a time was to say the next general election, that is the November general election. And that can lead to some confusion, which can be solved just by passing a few extra words. So this is something, again, to emphasize that we already do in Minnesota right now. It's just a question of the scope of what we do. So this would change nothing. Same process, same pending status in SVRS, which is the status given to people right now today that register, that pre-register, I should say, before 18. Again, it's not registration, it's pre-registration, so that all the steps can be completed. All of the screening and filtering can be done before they're 18, so that when they're 18, they can be on the voting rolls. I would just point out that this really is about getting good step habits started early. All the studies show from all over the country that the more that young people start thinking of themselves as voters, even before they actually are voters, the more likely they are to vote that first time they're eligible at 18, 19, 20, 21. And if people vote that first time that they're eligible at 18, 19, and so forth, they're far more likely to make it a lifelong habit. So this is a good bill. It's one that has enjoyed bipartisan support across the country and here in the Minnesota legislature, specifically on this committee and in the Minnesota House. So I'm pleased that Representative Wolgamont has taken up the baton from Representative Erdahl. And with that, in the remaining time I have, which is not a lot, I'm happy to stand for questions. Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski, I see your hands up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Wolgamont, for the bill. You know, members, when you go ice fishing, you want to make sure that there's enough ice under you so that you don't end up in the water. This bill is very, very thin. It's, you know, and the chart you get that shows, you know, if it's 2 inches thick, you can walk out on it. And if it's, you know, 18 inches thick, you can drive a car on it. Well, this is less than the one that you can walk out on. The water was all liquid. We had one night of freezing and there's just a skim of ice on the water. Nothing wants to walk on this, not even an insect. Members, this bill is worse than what we saw in the two very poor bills that we saw last week that predispose our election system to even more cheating and more defrauding than what we have now. So the one question I have, Mr. Chair, for Representative Wolgamont would be, Representative Wolgamont, my experience when I was 16, 17, 18, 19, that was the time in my life that I moved the most, whether it was within 1 year or whether it was over that 3 year period. There's a lot of moving, changing addresses going on more at that point in my life than any other. That's been my life experience. So I'm wondering, Representative Wolgamont, has that been yours as well?
Representative Wolgamont.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Drazkowski. Actually, my personal experience, for what that's worth, I was able to pre-register to vote, and I did vote after my 18th birthday at my home in which I was living when I was 16, 17, and 18. But to the broader point of your question, which I think is a good one, Representative Drazkowski, that we do know that students often move. Especially once they graduate high school. That's true, and that's a good question. What my advice to those young adults would be is my advice to every Minnesotan who moves, is that, you know, get registered to vote. That's a good thing to do. You know, we get used to the system, get used to the forms. But before you vote, you absolutely should check your voter registration status. You can do that at mnvotes.org. You can call your local election office. You can call the Secretary of State. Every Minnesotan before election day, if they've moved, should check and do that. And our 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds who would be involved in this should do that also. But again, you know, this is a win because students are familiar with the forms. They have the information. They'll be getting a little postcard in the mail that will verify their address. So, you know, their parents get that. They go, oh, I got to remind Junior to, you know, go on mnvotes.org and update their address. There are systems in place to make sure that Minnesotans are updating their addresses before election day, and that shouldn't be a deterrent to getting our young adult Minnesotans involved in the electoral process.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Wolgamont. Well, Representative Wolgamont, I was going to ask you how many people you know that actually do that. I don't think I know of anybody that does that and just calls in and checks out their voter registration status. There might be a small percentage of the population that does it, but I think what we're seeing here is where this bill is going to very much predispose us to situations where people are moving, their address information is no longer going to be accurate, and we're setting them up and our system up for more failure, more susceptibility to being defrauded, and more ability for people to cheat. And this is just a bad idea. The ice is really, really thin. nobody, none of these members should be walking out on this ice. Please vote no. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Wolgamott. I heard you say that you were in favor of people using ID in order to vote when they go to the polls, and I found that refreshing, and hope that you'll sign on to several of the voter ID bills that we've got moving through the system. It was pretty clear that I heard that when you were giving your intro, but nonetheless, I am not in favor of this bill. I think that, you know, registering 16-year-olds, I have a number of 16-year-olds that have passed through our home and just wasn't even on their minds. And that's even stranger when you consider that I do what you do. But when they got to be 17, we talked about it, and they were more than ready to do that because they were going to be turning 18, their eligible age to vote, by the time the next election came along. And I'm not really sure that the level of ambiguity in the language exists that you seem to think so, that by the next election. All you have to do is look on the current date of the calendar and say, hey, Siri, when's the next election? And wouldn't you know it, that that information becomes available. So I think this is a solution looking for a problem, and I would urge members to vote no.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wolgamott, I'm wondering, there are additional responsibilities for our county auditors in here. I do not see an appropriation to the counties. That would mean that this is an unfunded mandate to our counties. How would that be accounted for in this bill?
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative New Brindley. Again, this is codifying a rule that currently exists. So in talking about, you know, the what is being asked of our counties to do, that's what they're already doing. So this is not a new thing. It's simply codifying an existing rule.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you tell me, under the current rule, the counties are already required to interact with the post-secondary institutions, that is a requirement of the county auditors?
Representative Wolgamott.
Yes, that is an existing rule from the Secretary of State's office. And Mr. Chair, this might be a good opportunity for, I don't know if Secretary Simon is on or Nicole Freeman from the Secretary of State's office could give some more clarity on that existing rule.
Representatives, or Secretary Simon or Ms. Freeman, that looks like Secretary Simon's still here. Secretary yeah. Simon.
Thank you. I just briefly, yes, that is true. Representative Wolgamott said it exactly. There's already a pre-existing relationship under statute and rule. This just expands what's already there, as does the other part of the statute. However you view the thickness of the ice, it is what it is. And I think some of the criticisms would be a surprise to Representative Erdahl. We've been doing this for a long, long time, way before I had this job. This would just expand what we already do. There are many segments of our society, not just young people, who are very mobile, depending on what they do for a living, depending on economic conditions. And our system has been really able to accommodate that. And any 16-year-old, Representative Nash is spot on. Most 16-year-olds, let's face it, aren't among the milestones when they turn 16. I bet this is certainly behind getting a driver's license. I certainly understand it's not for everyone, but for those for whom it is something they want to pursue, I don't see any reason why it should be any different than their counterparts who are 17 years old.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this could be for Representative Wolgamott or Secretary Simon. Right now under the rulemaking, is that a shall? Or is it may? Are they required to notify the post-secondary institutions, or may they do that right now?
Secretary Simon.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley. Yes, right now it is a mandatory, I don't have the rule in front of me, but whatever the language is, must or shall or something like that. Yes, there's a mandatory arrangement there right now where institutions of higher education have to share certain residential lists. Representative Wolgamott's bill simply expands the scope of what that relationship already is.
Representative Bill Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this should be alarming to all of us, particularly on this committee, that that administrations and departments have rulemaking authority that create unfunded mandates. And so that should actually be alarming to all of us, that we are creating costs for our municipalities and our counties that don't actually go through the legislature and don't go through the legislative process. The other thing I would say, you know, on rule, on line 2.10 in that subdivision, you know, it clarifies that no one should be registered to vote if they are not eligible to vote. And this, of course, would exempt the requirement to be eligible to vote. Now, I understand that it is for this purpose, but we are now registering people to vote who are not eligible to vote and who will not be eligible to vote in the next election. I actually think that's a good standard. I think being eligible to vote in the next general election, which would be a very easy fix, actually, to clarify, we could just add general election, and that would similarly solve the problem, as you have stated it, Representative Wolgamott. I think it's a good standard that we are only registering people to vote who are eligible to vote. I think that that makes this very problematic. I think the only good news with this series of bills that we're hearing in committee is that, you know, at worst, they are wasting our time. They're not actually going to become law. So I suppose that's the good news. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wolgamott, the Secretary brings up an interesting point that this bill allows 16-year-olds to register to vote similar to 17-year-olds. But my question would be is why not 10-year-olds or 15-year-olds or 9-year-olds? And maybe if you want to have the best data, we've heard similar iterations of a bill like this last year. Why not just do it, register people to vote as soon as they get a birth certificate?
Representative Wolgamott.
That's just not the scope of my bill. The scope of my bill is 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wolgamott, I think it illustrates that the scope of your bill, you know, it's Valentine's Day. I don't love it. And we need to instill election integrity and confidence with our voters. One of the key issues that I hear is people are concerned that their votes are being manipulated and they don't have confidence in election results. And just like a few of the other bills in the bill last week, this bill doesn't instill more confidence in election integrity. And I think the scope of your bill needs to be relooked at. I can't support that, and I don't love it. Happy Valentine's Day.
Representative Bonner, and then we'll get to a vote here. Representative Bonner.
Thank you. I will be very brief, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Wolgamott, for bringing this bill forward. I think it's an excellent bill that really clarifies the statute, and I also think we should ground ourselves and remind everyone here that what we're essentially doing is guaranteeing the constitutional right to vote to folks who would be eligible when they become eligible. So I'm really appreciative, Dan, and I think Representative Wolgamott, of your efforts here, and really applaud the fact that we should be working as hard as we can to encourage students to exercise their civic duty. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 3021 be referred to the Committee on Higher Education. And Mr. Brinks, would you please take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
Nash, no.
Nash votes no. Representative Bonner.
Enthusiastically yes.
Bonner votes yay. Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Drazkowski votes nay. Representative Elkins.
Elkins votes aye.
Representative Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleborne.
Cleborne aye.
Cleborne votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick no.
Cosmic votes nay. Representative Mason?
Mason, aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley?
No.
New Brindley votes nay. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski votes aye. Representative Quam?
No.
Quam votes nay. With a vote of 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails. The bill is on its way to the Higher Ed Committee. Thank you, members. And now, members, we've got three presentations from that we didn't get to last week on the governor's budget request. And I'll start with the Minnesota Historical Society, Executive Director Ken Wentworth. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your tape or with your testimony.
For the record, my name is Ken Wentworth, and I serve as the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. Joining me is David Kelleher, Director of Public Policy and Governmental Relations. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present these two supplemental budget requests as recommended by the governor. We deeply appreciate your previous support for the work of the Minnesota Historical Society, particularly in the 2021 session. The first request is one that will be familiar to you. This request is for an operating adjustment of $500,000 in FY23. These funds would be used to pay for increased cost of employee health care and staff compensation. Actually, the amount represents the difference between the governor's recommendation from last year in the 2021 session and the amount that was ultimately appropriated. As I mentioned, this funding would allow us to properly support staff compensation and benefit. The second request is for cost of reopening historic sites and museums, as well as reopening history programs. This request is for $750,000 for FY23. Now, certainly the Minnesota Historical Society is not the only organization that has been hit hard by the pandemic and economic challenges. But we have had closures and have been slow to recover pre-pandemic visitation levels, as have many in our field. We have had closures and have been slow to recover pre-pandemic visitation levels. The important activities that supplement state general fund dollars are earned revenue. And that revenue comes from admissions, comes from store sales, and other revenue-generating activities. This revenue has been millions of dollars behind pre-pandemic levels, almost $4 million in FY20 and about $2 million in FY21. This request would help to bridge our reopening efforts until revenue-generating activities get back up to full speed. Visitation comes from a variety of audience types. They include family visitors, tourists, and school children. Not surprising to any of us, school groups have been very slow to return. Our hope is that in this calendar year, perhaps as soon as this spring, school groups will start to return to historic sites and to the History Center, and that we can support their visits with the proper level of staffing. Throughout the pandemic, we have adjusted hours at our sites, and we will continue to tweak operations based on visitation patterns. Mr. Chair, that concludes my formal remarks, and I and my colleague David Kelleher are happy to answer questions that you or the committee may have. Thank you again for your support from the committee for the Minnesota Historical Society.
Mr. Whitworth, is Mr. Kelleher here? Kelleher here, it's a tongue twister, here to just answer questions, or does he have remarks?
Mr. Chair, just here to answer questions as they come up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelleher. With that, members, questions? Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I'm wondering, and I apologize if I missed this during your presentation, I'm wondering, though, if you can let us know the total of the lost revenue that you've had from the closures over the last year and the decrease in expenses as well from being closed.
Mr. Whitworth?
Chair Nelson, Representative New Brindley, the earned income lost goes back actually to the first year of the pandemic and continues. In FY 20, in that last quarter, we lost between $3 and $4 million. In FY 21, we lost at least $2 million. And we are only part of the way through the current fiscal year, but revenue lags behind pre-pandemic levels. Our expenses have been down somewhat, but beginning in the previous fiscal year, we started a gradual turn of the dial, if you will, to reopen. And that's when our operating expenses of our 26 historic sites in the network started to get back up to pre-pandemic levels. So at this stage of the game, we are experiencing both a slight reduction in expenses, but also a significant reduction in earned income.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Kelleher and Mr. our Commissioner Director Whitworth, for your testimony. The next person I have on the list here is from the Board of Accountancy, and we have Executive Director Doreen Johnson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Doreen Johnson. I am the Executive Director at the Board of Accountancy. It's a pleasure to be here. Chair, representatives, and members of the public, it's an honor, and I appreciate the ability to talk about our request for a supplemental budget item, which will be one additional full-time staff member for the Board of Accountancy. I had two slides, and I can't see from my presentation if you can see them. So, Amanda, if you could. If not, I will just proceed with my testimony, either way. So the Board of Accountancy addresses regulation for certified public accountants. We have approximately 20,000 licensees, and in an average year, we handle approximately 200 complaints, except for automatic revocations, which I won't go into right now. But the other thing that's interesting about the Board of Accountancy is we share back office with the Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design. Why is that important today? It's important because it's one of the reasons why I'm coming and asking for the full-time equivalent. I'm the director of that agency as well. I'm 0.5 to each agency, and both agencies had interagency agreements to assist on licensing, regulation, enforcement, and that all worked really well until we lost people that had been here for many, many years, retirement, leaving, and when you are hiring someone, you are hiring them for a single agency, and we quickly became aware of the fact that the interagency agreements for one agency wasn't going to work well for the other one because we no longer had the longevity, the institutional knowledge, the ability to quickly turn around and do understand two sets of statutes and rules and the processes involved in your individual job. And these are union positions. I also want to point out that the Board of Accountancy's fees, licensing fees, go directly to the general fund, and we are a small profit to the state budget, and we are seeking the funding for one full-time equivalent so I can return one of our staff members back to the complaint processing, and this position is to assist with licensing, and it is a line item request in the supplemental budget request.
And Ms. Johnson, what would be the dollar amount of that?
$120,000 per year.
Question, members of Ms. Johnson. Just give it a second here. If not, I see nobody. Oh, there goes Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I tried to hit the button. I was less than successful.
That's why I try and go slow.
I appreciate that. I'm just wondering, I don't remember, frankly, from a year ago, was this request made during the regular budget cycle as well?
Ms. Johnson.
Representative, and Mr. Chair, no, it was not. We weren't looking at the retirements, number one. Number two, at the very beginning of the budget cycle, we weren't really encouraged to ask for new FTEs. This was right at the very issues of having budget problems within the state, possibly before we had a surplus. But the bigger issue was we tried to operate using the employees that were currently here, stepping up and filling the gaps from both agencies. So it was not asked in the original budget.
And members, if we remember, we started our budget cycle last year, that they were predicting a huge deficit. Didn't know what the effect of the COVID would be on, but we did have a quick drop, but we did a quick reboot. And so as we put our budgets together last year, we were being very responsible in how we budgeted, because we were looking at possibly having a deficit. We've been very happy that that didn't happen, but that's where we're at now. So Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I believe we still grew government by about 12%. So I'm not sure that's a valid argument for not doing what needs to be done. And I guess I would just say then, particularly state government is fully funded, and I would not support making these changes right now during a non-budget year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you,
Mr. NOC.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. If you were being responsible last year when there was a deficit, I imagine you're being irresponsible this year with a surplus, and that validates what I'm seeing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. I don't know if I'd go there, but again, this is, as we've all know, that sometimes when you have money in the bank, we get more requests than we have money to spend. And sometimes it's harder to budget during a surplus than it is during a deficit. Any further questions of Ms. Johnson? If not, thank you for your testimony and thank you for your time.
Thank you for your support.
You're welcome. Next person we have is from the Minnesota Humanities Center, the Chief Executive Officer, Kevin Lindsay. For some reason, I saw a V in there in the wrong place. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Lindsay, and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Nelson and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to present to you today. This is a portion of the governor's budget. It is a two-part request on behalf of the governor and the Minnesota Humanities Center, one for providing additional dollars to shore up the absence of being able to provide health care benefits for our staff, and then also a small increase as relates to our IT respective needs. In response to the question which was asked by the Board of Accountancy, the Minnesota Humanities Center would echo the sentiment is that individual entities, organizations that receive general operating funds were informed by MMB not to put forth any requests because the government at that point in time was trying to shore up resources to be able to respond to the COVID pandemic. And I appreciate that we are in a much better position now than what it looked like back then. So that's for the timing of this. So for those committee members that are aware of the Minnesota Humanities Center, we're located on the east side of St. Paul. The legislature had provided bonding funding for the Minnesota Humanities Center. We have finished the work. So you'll see the new building, the new office and event center that we have will look different than this photo. But again, I just wanted to thank again the legislature for providing that bonding. For the Minnesota Humanities Center, again, 50% of this increase, adjusting the general fund-based funding, 50% for the cost of living increase for salaries and benefits, 50% to modernize MHC's IT infrastructure. And again, as a statewide, as an organization, nonprofit that serves the entire state of Minnesota as an affiliate to the National Endowment for the Humanities, it's important for us to be able to reach and provide information on grant opportunities for organizations all throughout the state, as well as to deliver programs for the entirety of the state. We have about 350 events each year at our event center. So again, the impact to us by COVID was significant. Over the last couple of years, we lost a significant amount of revenue from the closure of that respective building. Oops, well, a little too fast then. So again, just the impact here is to help us maintain current staffing levels, continue to provide high quality programming and service. The humanities disciplines, the work of civics and jurisprudence is echoed here today, is part of the respective work that the Minnesota Humanities does. The work, though, I would say in the last 2 years, the time I have been there, a strong sense calling from all across the state for more work, more opportunities and partnership with the Minnesota Humanities Center. Appreciated seeing Representative Nash at an event this past summer at the Buddhist Cambodian temple, which is one of the largest in the entire world, as an example of that. And again, the other half of this increase, purchase laptops and help us secure software. So again, we can deliver high quality programming and service throughout the state. So again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, appreciate this opportunity to present before you and to present this portion of the governor's budget.
Thank you, Mr. Lindsay. And I'll ask the first question is, what is the dollar amount that that you're requesting?
The dollar amount is $22,000.
Thank you, Mr. Lindsay. Representative Nash, I see you have your hand up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, thank you. It was nice to be at the temple, but I was actually there on behalf of my role on the board of the Council for Asian and Pacific Islander Minnesotans, not for anything other than that. And I wasn't sure that humanities had any role in that. I think that was put on by Ms. Herr. But question for you, how much of the increase that you're asking for is attributable to the crushing wave of inflation that we've been seeing lately?
Mr. Lindsay.
I would say I'm not an economist, so I can't directly attribute a dollar number to that, but I do appreciate the fact that many employers are sensing a need to pay competitive wages and benefits to their employees, and we're no different than some of those employers.
Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Commissioner, you are a little different because you're actually coming to the legislature asking for the money tree to be shaken when these other businesses cannot. They do not have the ability to fight inflation in the way that you've just described. They don't have that ability at all. So while you've tried to minimize this as just a $22,000 increase, I can think of 100 different businesses in the area that would love to be able to shake the tree for just $22,000, if not more than we've seen in other areas. So again, I think this is just another instance of folks rushing to seek more spending when we have looked at a time of surplus. And if you remember last week, I talked about where does a surplus come from. It doesn't come, as we all know, from a money tree. It comes from the wallets of the people who live around the state who are literally treading water. They're not able to tread much longer. They're going to go under. And they don't have a way to come and make a one-time request and have it bestowed on them. So this is something that I think is worth conversation because I don't think it's something that we should be doing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash, and thank you, Mr. Lindsay, for your testimony, and thank you for your time.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could, I just want to make sure that Representative Nash identified me in the record as commissioner. My current position is the CEO of the Minnesota Humanities Center.
Thank you, Mr. Lindsay. Sometimes we get those things confused, and yes, it's different titles anyway. And Representative Nash, it could be argued too that some of the inflation is being caused by prices being raised by businesses who are trying to make up for losses that they had and their increased costs. So that's an argument we can have another day. Thank you, Mr. Lindsay. Thank you, Governor's staff, for your presentations. Next members we have, we're gonna get an update from our CGIP EPM with the MMB, the study that we have or that we the bill we passed last year, where it's at. And I have Lorna Smith here listed as from MMB, and I have Pat Arsenault, I hope I said that right, from the IFO. And so Ms. Smith, you want to proceed, identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony and tell us where we're at with the reverse auction procedure process.
Certainly. Good morning, Chair Nelson and members. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Lorna Smith. I'm the Director for Employee Insurance at Minnesota Management and Budget. As stated, I'm here today to give a brief update on the selection of a new pharmacy benefit manager, commonly known as a PBM. We currently contract with CVS Caremark to administer the prescription drug benefit program that's provided to state employees, retirees, and their eligible dependents. Management and unions made the decision to contract with a PBM about 13 years ago. The current contract is a result of a request for proposal, or RFP, that was conducted by both management and union representatives. This contract expires on December 31st of this year, and we're in the process of selecting a vendor for a new five-year contract. Last session, a new provision was added to statute that requires CIGIP to contract with the PBM and to procure those services with the aid of a platform vendor. The platform vendor is required to conduct a reverse auction to select the PBM, and then, once a contract is in place, to conduct certain ongoing services to ensure that the state receives what it is owed under the PBM contract. The statute lays out a process to be followed to procure both vendors and the specific requirements that each vendor must meet. The first step requiring the statute was to contract with a PBM platform vendor. We issued an RFP for a platform vendor this past summer. Two vendors responded. A selection committee of management union representatives selected Treveris. Treveris is an industry leader in this field. We're confident they meet all the statutory requirements, and they have the right staff, experience, and technology to successfully conduct reverse auction and provide ongoing services. A contract with Treveris was executed this past October. The next step is to issue an RFP to select a new PBM. This RFP is conducted entirely through the Treveris platform. They loaded it with our current plan design and other data that will serve as a status quo by which responses will be considered. Then both MMB and the unions worked with Treveris to develop the RFP that will solicit a PBM. This RFP consists of a questionnaire, terms, and financials. The financials are a detailed list of items such as dispensing fees, average wholesale price discounts, and financial guarantees. For each item, responders will enter a specific price. The terms are statements that responders either agree to or they explain why they disagree. They include areas such as claim processing, network, specialty management, and a host of other areas that comprise PBM services. The state unions also included some custom terms that ensure the selected PBM will meet needs specific to the state's program. These were items such as agreeing to meet the state's standard contract requirements and agreeing to electronically connect with our health plans. Finally, the questionnaire is a list of questions that MMB normally asked its responders to its RFPs. These include topics such as the vendor's experience, stability of the company, and how they ensure member privacy. One important part of the RFP is to understand the disruption to members that will be caused by the selected responder compared to the status quo. It compares networks. What pharmacies are in the current network, but not in the responder's network. It also compares formularies. What drugs are not on the responder's list that are on the current formulary or are available at a higher cost. The opposite's also considered. What improvements would be made to the network and the formulary if a responder was selected? These items are important because this is what causes the most pain for members as we go through a PBM change. The RFP announcement was published in the State Register on January 31st. Currently, 12 PBMs have expressed intent to compete for the contract. The response to the RFP are conducted through three bid phases, and the unions are involved in each phase. These phases are the reverse auction. We've just entered the first phase, and it ends on March 16th. During this round, responders accept or reject the terms, complete the questionnaire, and make their first financial bid. Phase two will end on April 29th. During this phase, we work with bidders on the reconsideration of terms. Responders are informed of their financial rankings compared to other bidders, and they improve their financial bids. Phase three ends May 31st. Again, bidders will be informed of their financial ranking and can improve their bids. We will have an identified winner, and the PBM contract will be executed by approximately June 30th. Once a PBM contract is signed, both Traverse and the selected PBM will prepare for service that will begin on January 1st of 2023. The PBM will provide the formulary network, claims management, and clinical programs. Traverse will conduct regular claim-by-claim invoice reviews and adjudication, annual market checks, and other functions to ensure we're receiving all that was agreed to under the PBM contract. Members, with that, my presentation is complete, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. And next we have Pat Arsenault. And are you here to have, do you have a presentation, or are you here to answer questions? Ms. Arsenault.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I just have a couple of things I'd like to say. I don't have a PowerPoint, but if I can just make a few comments, and then I will also stand for questions.
Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, my name is Pat Arsenault, and I am the labor co-chair of the Joint Labor Management Committee on Health Plans. And I just wanted to thank you for passing this very important legislation to provide for the reverse auction for the selection of a PBM. I just wanted to note that labor is, in particular, is appreciative of this committee's effort and work to ensure our participation throughout this reverse auction process. To date, and I believe Director Smith noted this, that we have been included, the unions have been included in the technology vendor selection. And we participated in that process. We think it was important that we participated so that we can tell our members, state employees, that we have been included in each component of this process. And also that we can say, as Director Smith noted, we too have confidence in the technology vendor that was selected through the process. You know, we have confidence in Traverse that they can carry out what the state requires them to do. And then as also noted, the union reps are involved in this current RFP process to select the next PBM. We've been working with the technology vendor, as was noted in Director Smith's PowerPoint slide. And I just wanted to note that we believe one of the key benefits of adopting this process is the transparency that it brings by this built-in partnership with this outside platform vendor, and also because this legislation provides this claims auditing in real time, it provides that accountability that we think both the transparency that this process provides and the accountability guarantees that the PBM is carrying out the contract as promised. And so from the union standpoint, we just look forward to continuing in this process, and we remain confident that state employees and the state will realize the savings that were discussed when this legislation was being considered and passed. And I just wanted to thank you for allowing me to speak with you today.
Thank you, Ms. Arsenault. Members, any questions? I know we had lots and lots of questions last year when they started this, and we're able to get all the things worked out. Representative Bonner.
Thank you so much. And I had a question. I know when we originally thought about this particular topic, there was some question or concern about whether or not we would have a plethora of good vendors to choose from. And in selecting a final individual. So I just wondered if we could speak just briefly to that, if we had some good contenders in the bunch. It does sound that we've selected one, and obviously being a little bit more IT focused, I also want to make sure that that we have a good level of confidence that the vendor we've chosen is ready, willing, and able to step up in terms of technology solutions to deliver on the contract.
Ms. Smith, I'm assuming you want to answer that question.
Yes, thank you, members, Chair Nelson. We're highly confident in Traveras. They are certainly an industry leader, and I think they've set the bar for technology. We think that the most qualified vendors did respond to our RFP, and we're very confident in the choice that we made.
Representative Bonner.
Wonderful. Thank you for that update. I really appreciate that. I know it had been a concern and just wanted to kind of weigh in on how that had turned out. Thanks so much.
Any further questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Smith, Ms. Arsenal, for your testimony, your time, and thank you for joining the committee today. Now, members, we are going to recess here shortly and come back, like I said, 30 minutes after session, but no later than 4:30. We have two more bills to take up, Representative Fraser's bill, and which we should receive from the floor today. And so with that, members, there are no more questions. We are in recess. And everybody, welcome back. With reconvening State Government Finance Committee for today, February 14th, 2022. We discussed earlier and now we're back. The bill before us now is House File 2900, Representative Fraser's bill. I will move House File 2900 to be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Welcome to the committee, Representative Fraser, if you want to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, lead, and the committee members. I'm here today to talk about frontline worker pay, which is House File 2900. Just as a quick overview, you know, for over the last almost 2 years now, our frontline workers have been working day in and day out, going to work in person while we've been in the midst of this pandemic. There was a period of time where we had to stay at home order where many of us were able to stay home, work virtually, and shelter in place and be safe away from exposure to COVID-19. Many of our frontline workers, all of our frontline workers did not have the opportunity to do that. So when they went in and day out on a daily basis to work to make sure that Minnesota could keep moving forward, they were exposing themselves and also exposing their families to COVID-19. We've identified those frontline workers as best we can, working closely with the department with Deed and Dolly. We'll have testimony from the commissioner today. And this bill is pretty straightforward. You know, if you worked in person, if that was the nature of your job, any of the frontline sectors that we've identified, if you were outside your household working in person with folks that were not from your family, if you worked for at least 120 hours during a peacetime emergency, which was between March 15, 2020 through June 30th, 2021 in Minnesota, and if you meet the income limits, you will be eligible for up to $1,500 pay as a frontline worker. There will be an application process, and once the application process is closed, then those payments will go out to frontline workers that were eligible. Chair, with that quick overview, I'll answer any questions, but I believe now we'll go to our testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Fraser. Yes, we have a whole list of testifiers and member and people. I would like it if you can keep your comments to around 2 minutes, that would be very helpful so we can get through to everybody. And with that, I think the first person on my list here is Commissioner Rosalind Robertson. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. My name is Rosalind Robertson. I am the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. I'm pleased to be here today to testify in support of House File 2900, which provide well-deserved and long-awaited recognition for Minnesota frontline workers for the extraordinary sacrifices they made to keep Minnesota running during the COVID pandemic, which we all know is not quite over yet. This past summer and fall, I had the opportunity to represent the WALS administration on the frontline worker pay work group. As a member of the group, I heard hours of testimony from frontline workers about their reality during the pandemic. They continue to face many of these challenges today. These workers deserve to be respected, protected, and paid for the sacrifices that they have made and continue to make. Whether it's healthcare or meatpacking, childcare, education, or grocery workers, the Walz administration remains committed to recognizing each frontline worker who have sacrificed so very much. I'm very pleased that Governor Walz has included $1 billion for frontline worker pay in his supplemental budget. The data confirms that the workers who were unable to work from home and had to show up to the workplace in close proximity of others were and continue to be at greater risk for contracting COVID. We have lots of statistics, but in the interest of time, the bottom line is this pandemic have impacted workers from all sectors. Many areas hit extremely hard. For examples, there were over just in 2020, and we know we're not quite done yet, but in 2020 alone, there were 3,500 of COVID cases associated with cluster outbreaks in the meatpacking processing plants. Over 2,000 cases were active in clusters in retail and grocery stores. As I said, we have other statistics that demonstrate how specific industries were hit. However, the one thing that all of these industries have in common is that they showed up to work and they worked alongside patients, coworkers, students, community residents, despite the risks that doing so presented to them and their family. I'm here to testify in support of this bill because it provides these frontline workers with some recognition and compensation for their incredible commitment and sacrifices. In conclusion, I want to thank the committee for allowing me to testify, and I ask the committee members to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. The next person I have on my list is, Brianne? The name disappeared on me here. Or is it Mary Turner? Amanda, Mary Turner? Mary Turner from the Nurses Association. Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary C. Turner. I am the elected president of Minnesota Nurses Association, but I always say more importantly, I have been a COVID ICU nurse on the night shift at North Memorial Medical Center in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. We represent 80% of the bedside care nurses in our hospitals and over 22,000 nurses across the state. It seems like a lifetime that I've been speaking on this topic at committee hearings like this, rallies, press conferences, Facebook forums, but I tell you what, the story hasn't changed. It hasn't changed for the nurses. It hasn't changed for other frontline workers. Nurses have worked longer shifts, more shifts. We have put ourselves and our families at risk. We have gone to extraordinary lengths to protect our families by living apart from them. We have lost pay when we have had, like other frontline workers, when we've had to quarantine to keep our families safe. All of the other issues that all the other frontline workers will talk about, we have done in the nursing profession. But one thing is, we, like all of us, we have continued to serve the people of Minnesota, to serve our patients. You know, as a leader of this fight, at times I've gotten discouraged and wavered, and I'll be honest, a little bit despairing that we would ever see the end to this. until Friday. Friday afternoon, I was approached by the fire marshal in the state of Minnesota, and he came to me and he said, Mary, we lost another fireman. This is the fourth one we've lost to COVID in the last month. His funeral is tomorrow. And that brought me back to the memorial service that I went not too long ago to a fallen nurse in our organization who died from COVID. So I no longer waver. And I've said before that you don't need to call us heroes, but darn it, I've changed my mind. What we've done for the last 2 years for the people of Minnesota is heroic. And you know why? Because every single sector of the frontline workers have given up lives to serve the people of Minnesota. So please pass House File 2900 to give just a bit of recognition to the sacrifices and the commitment that we have more than willing shown to the Minnesota people. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. The next person I have on my list is Stacy Armstrong. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Is Stacy here? There she is, yes. Please unmute yourself. You're muted.
Okay. Is it better now?
Yep, I can hear you now. You're unmuted. Thank you.
All right. Sorry about that. All right. Members of the House and Senate, my name is Stacy Armstrong, and I live in Oakdale, Minnesota. And I'm here today to voice my support to this committee in favor of providing the $1,500 frontline worker pay for essential workers. I joined the UFCW Local 663 in the year 2019, and I currently work at Cub Foods in Rosemount, Minnesota. I was hired as an assistant manager at Cub Foods initially at the UNFI corporate offices in Eden Prairie. My position there was temporarily eliminated due to the corporate shutdown caused by COVID-19. So I was placed at the Cub Rosemount store. However, this position, as the pandemic progressed, my position then became permanent. And now I'm the assistant manager in the deli. And the corporate offices are closed indefinitely. Since I've been at the Cub Foods at Rosemont, I first got COVID myself in November of 2020. The second time I got COVID was April of 2021. And I just recently had my third bout with COVID, was January of 2022. Both my children have had COVID twice, my daughter-in-law and my granddaughter. And my roommate is now recovering from COVID-19 and had lost his sister this past summer to the virus. This pay is important to me personally because I've lost significant income due to this loss of work. I've incurred medical bills as well as medical issues due to this virus. I'm a single person. Therefore, I'm the sole breadwinner of my household. These issues have brought me great anxiety, depression, headaches, sleeping problems, not to mention lost time spent with family and friends. This is important to all of us because we have family and financial obligations, and we are continually in contact with the public. And that makes us more susceptible to the virus and the need to quarantine with each exposure or possible exposure
will and has caused anxiety and depression, as well as financial issues. And the daily fear of getting the virus, dealing with the public who at times are hostile towards us, is a constant struggle and cause of great stress. I believe that this money, this influx of money, will help the employees feel more valued and that their employer actually is looking out for their well-being. I think it should help some of the financial burdens incurred due to the sickness or the quarantine. However, my story is not just about me. It's about thousands of us essential workers who are continuing to put our lives out there on the line throughout the pandemic across the state. And, you know, especially the workers who do not have a union to back them up. So please make this right and include all the essential workers in the frontline worker pay program. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Armstrong. And members, too, our testifiers, you can try and keep it under 2 minutes. We've got a lot of other testifiers, and so we need to get through everybody, and that way everyone will have a chance to speak their piece. The next person I have on my list is Rodney Reichs. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chair and committee members, my name is Rodney Reichs, and I live in Austin, Minnesota. I have been a meat packer at Hormel Foods for 27 years and a member of the UFCW Local 663. COVID-19 has put a lot of stress on my life. I am at high risk for many reasons. I have Barrett's esophagus, which means my esophagus is at a high risk of cancer. I was born without a sphincter valve in my throat. I had surgery called an Eson fund location. It's where they tie your stomach around your esophagus. So if I get sick or nauseous, I can't throw up. All I get is dry heaves. They are extremely painful. I also have had pneumonia 3 times. The last time was recently during COVID-19 pandemic. I was coughing up blood for 3 days. I worked every day I could, except for the week I was coughing blood. Otherwise, I worked every day wondering if I would catch COVID from a coworker. But we had a job to do, and that was to keep America, Minnesota, and the world supplied with food. When grocery stores were out of sanitizers and toilet paper and other essentials, no grocery store ever ran out of food. There were shortages, but no one ever ran out completely. We worked 6-7 days a week keeping production going, always with the worry of, are we going to get sick? Are we going to take the virus home to our families? Are we going to infect our families? But we never gave up. There was a need, and we were going to fill that, and we were going to do whatever it took to fill that need. That's what packing house workers do. We work hard to feed America's families. Please honor the work we do and pass the $1,500 bonus checks into law as fast as you can. We never let you down, so please don't overlook those workers who worked every day through the pandemic so families would have food on the table. Thank you very much for your time and consideration. Also, packing houses were ordered by the President of the United States to stay open and continue running, and we did that. We did it for America. We did it for the people of the state of Minnesota. And we did it for the world. That's what we do. We're packing house workers.
Thank you, Mr. Ricks. Thank you for your service. The next person on my list is Gina Dupre. Oh, excuse me. I will do Gina first, and then I skipped one. But Gina,
okay.
Thank you. It's welcome to the committee. Jenna, state your name for the tape.
It's Jenna Dupre.
Okay.
And thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jenna Dupre. I'm a food service coordinator for Minneapolis Public Schools and a member of SEIU Local 284. But more than that, I'm an essential worker. Before March of 2020, that meant I would drive in on snow days, making sure that if our students showed up, we coordinators would be there. We have about 56% of our students at MPS that receive free and reduced lunch. So it's important that if students arrive at school, we're there to feed them. Since COVID began, being an essential employee means that not only do coordinators come in, but also food service assistants, prep cooks, production cooks, warehouse workers, lead prep cooks, all of these positions are now considered essential due to the pandemic. During COVID, we served as many as 100,000 meals every few weeks. We are there for MPS students. But to be there, we are putting our own safety and the safety of our families on the line every day. We did this because our students need us. But most of the time, we weren't able to take the precautions we needed to be safe. We not only couldn't work from home, we couldn't always socially distance like everyone at the start didn't have the protections we needed to be safe. I regularly saw six people working at a packaging table, shoulder to shoulder, with only homemade cotton masks. We worked together at these tables in a room of roughly 50 food service workers. I also saw people who didn't have access to face shields or other needed PPE, even after we requested it. After federal protections went away, workers across the state who might have COVID symptoms felt they needed to go into work and earn their paycheck. We simply did not have the choice to stay safe. This happened in our schools, our healthcare facilities, in food processing centers, in childcare, and more. Essential workers simply had to keep showing up even when it was dangerous. Our work is why we have this giant surplus. The frontline worker pay bill providing $1,500 checks to frontline workers won't make up for the dangers and stress we faced while working to feed our students, but it will show the state recognizes our sacrifices. We have stepped up, done what is needed during this pandemic, but too often we have felt like we're on our own. I hope you hear our stories and pass this bill as soon as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dupre. The next person on my list is Becca Davey. Are you there, Becca? It looks like she's either having trouble or getting them. Oh, there she is. Welcome to the committee. Restate your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Becca Davey. Let's see. Chair and committee members, my name is Becca Davey, and I live in Rosemont. I am here today to voice my support to this committee in favor of providing $1,500 frontline worker pay for essential workers. I joined UFCW Local 663 in May of 2020 and currently work at Lunds and Byerly's in Eagan. I'm an inventory control specialist, which also covers pricing and receiving. I have constant contact with all vendors that come in. I change all the prices in the store of all the items, which include constant contact with employees and customers. I did online shopping when I was first hired, which also had me in constant contact with customers and other people. I started this new position in January of 2021. As you can see, I'm always around people, whether it's customers, vendors, or my fellow employees. Frontline worker pay is important to me personally because through this entire pandemic, I have never taken a day off and we've never closed down. I constantly have to deal with people who either don't believe in the vaccine or because they've been vaccinated and don't want to follow our company's policy that all vendors wear a mask because they say that other companies don't require it. Even though I've never had COVID, I have been told numerous times I've been exposed by family and friends, some who've had COVID, including both my parents and my boyfriend's son just recently. I have taken numerous COVID tests, a couple I have paid for out of pocket just to be cleared by work. It's getting a little tiring to say the least. Please help the thousands of deserving essential workers who continue to put their lives on the line during this pandemic across the state by making this law as quickly as possible. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Davey. Thank you for your service. Next I have Leslie Powell.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Leslie Powell. I have been a janitor for 8 years, and I work at Southdale Medical Center. My husband is also a janitor, and we are proud members of SEIU Locals 26, a union of over 8,000 property service workers. Working in person during COVID has been emotionally exhausting. Frontline workers like me have had to deal with a building full of people who know better, but who are not taking every precaution they can during the pandemic. When a person goes maskless at a medical building, it's a special kind of risky. I try to be understanding, but it's hard not to feel as if people don't care that the people that empty their medical trash and deal with their bodily fluids are at a special level of risk. This is the third winter we have lived in terror of getting deathly ill. There are so many of us that never got to work from home. And not one, not the company, not the landlord, nor our elected officials have ever managed to give due consideration to those of us whose jobs became 1,000 times more hazardous over the 2+ years since COVID-19 arrived in the United States. Over 1,000 members of our union caught COVID and had to miss paychecks, and sadly, 5 members of our Local 26 died. When the vaccine first came out, neither the building nor the company offered to give us the vaccine, even though we were, along with medical workers, some of the most exposed people to the virus. We had to get it through governmental efforts. The only other people to offer us vaccines was my union, SEIU, along with a non-governmental organization of African immigrants, which I am forever grateful for. I am here today with a simple request. Please pass frontline worker pay. A $1,500 check would help us so we can pay bills, buy groceries, buy medicine, clothes, PPE. We've already earned this bump by keeping the machine running. We've kept buildings clean and our economy running, helping create this budget surplus. We worked hard during an existential threat that I must remind everyone is still not over. I watch my coworkers come into work in rickety old cars that are getting shaken apart by the roads that they refuse to fix because rich people don't want to pay taxes. My spouse and I take zero deductions, have 2 incomes and no kids. We still owe taxes at the end of the year. We are 2 janitors that paid more taxes than Amazon. So it's time to do something to recognize the sacrifices of the people who kept our state running. It's time for you all to do something that helps working people and not just these big corporations. These checks won't fix the huge issues so many people are facing, but it will be a step. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for fighting for this important bill, and I urge you all to pass the frontline worker pay bill as soon as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Powell. My understanding is Brianne Bernini is here now. Brianne?
I'm here.
Identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Hello. My name is Brianne Bernini. I live in Plymouth. I'm an emergency center tech at Methodist Hospital, but I'm also an executive board member of my union, SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We support HF 2900 because it provides a broad group of healthcare workers a significant bonus of up to $1,500. The COVID-19 pandemic hit my hospital like a runaway freight train. I remember 1 week in late February of 2020 asking a doctor if he thought COVID would come to Minnesota. He assured me it wouldn't be a big deal. Within a week, we were rushing to completely rearrange our hospital to deal with COVID. We now have the correct PPE, but at the start, like many places, we never had enough PPE. For months, I had one N95 respirator. It was meant to be worn once, whenever entering a dangerous area. Instead, I wore it for my entire 12-hour shift. And at the end of the shift, instead of disposing of the mask, I put it in a paper bag and sent it to be sterilized. I would need to wear that mask for 10 days in a row. I was one of the lucky ones. My coworkers in EVS and other departments had to make do with inferior surgical masks, even when they cleaned a room where a COVID patient had been. Essential workers outside of the hospital also had to take risks with even less protection than hospital workers. My father, who's over 65 and vulnerable, worked in a grocery store so that all of us could get the food and supplies we needed. In part because of lack of PPE, I was infected with COVID-19 in November of 2020. I'm pretty sure that I had another registered nurse also affected by the same elderly patient with dementia who had COVID and kept removing her mask. I had to quarantine for 2 weeks. The presumptive workers' compensation law you passed was the only reason that my quarantine time was paid. I have not gotten a COVID bonus or premium pay from my employer. The hardest part of my COVID quarantine was the time I lost. When I quarantined, I had to stay in one part of my house away from my husband. I knew it would be a long 2 weeks without seeing him, but I wanted to make sure he was protected. Before my quarantine ended, my husband passed away suddenly. COVID took away the last time I would ever have to spend with him. Even now, like other widows, I seek comfort in the lingering smell of his clothes. But because of COVID, I can't smell anything. COVID took that away from me. I know you can't give me back the time or take away the horrible memories of the fear and terror us hospital workers have lived through, but a significant bonus to all of us hospital workers would at least show us that our community appreciates the sacrifices we have made to protect them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bernini. The next person I have on my list is Estella Tirado. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Estella?
So Estella will be using an interpreter. Estella, ¿estás?
Sí.
Okay, dice que te identifiques y procedas con tu testimonio, okay?
Sí, hola, buenas tardes. Soy Estela Tirado. Trabajo en el centro del Dantau.
So my name is Estela Tirado, and I work in downtown Minneapolis.
Sí, me gustaría que nos dieran a los trabajadores los 1,500, porque la verdad, pues, personalmente yo sí lo necesito, porque este año he tenido muchas pérdidas, tanto como por el COVID-19.
Yes, good afternoon. I would like to share, please, that this essential worker pay, this $1,500, is passed because honestly, personally, like I know I need it. This year alone, I've suffered many losses, both from COVID-19 as well as.
Porque necesito para la medicina. Como alimentación, que en este año me he enfermado mucho y para mí sería de mucha utilidad esos 1,500 porque ahorita estoy bien alcanzada como en para medicinas, renta, comida.
You know, this money would also mean a lot. I need medicine. I need nourishment. You know, this year I've gotten sick a lot, and this $1,500 would mean a lot. You know, I'm oversaturated, overwhelmed between medications and rent and food for myself and my family.
Nos ha afectado mucho como en el trabajo. Menos horas por este COVID que había en este año muchos contagios. Entonces nos perjudicó mucho en los trabajos que nos daban menos horas. Y a veces hasta los días nos cortaban. Entonces realmente sí lo necesito y necesito.
COVID and the pandemic has affected us a lot at work. It has also meant, especially this year, less hours because of the pandemic. There's been a lot of outbreaks and surges, and that's affected us at work. It means less hours. Sometimes whole days get cut, and this money would mean a lot.
Pues eso es lo que diría yo, pues, de mi parte, que sí quiero que, pues, que den ese dinero, porque la verdad yo sí lo necesito, porque no he trabajado ahorita mismo durante ya un mes y sigo sin trabajar porque pues me he sentido un poquito mal de salud y por eso es que he necesitado para medicinas, comida, renta. Y no sé si me vayan a pagar de los días de enfermedad en mi trabajo, la verdad no estoy segura.
You know, I just would like to say also this money means a lot for our health. For instance, I haven't been able to work for most of this month due to health concerns. And for instance, I don't know if my boss will actually pay me for the sick time in my job. That is not certain.
Y eso sería todo de mi parte, de mi testimonio y mi petición, que realmente sí nos reconocieran como trabajadores que hemos luchado por hacernos las cosas bien como trabajadores y que también reconozcan nuestros derechos.
Thank you. That is what I would like to share for my testimony and in my petition to pass this $1,500 for essential workers. Ask that you recognize us as workers who have fought for this and fought to do things right for ourselves and other workers, for our rights. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
The next person I have on my list is Marbella Herrera Villanueva, do you need the interpreter also?
Yes, Marbella needs interpretation. I need to just check if she's here, just because there hasn't been interpretation. Marbella, está? Marbella, estás en la línea? We can move ahead and I can try to see if the iPhone on the line is her, if she can hear us.
Okay. And the next one I have is, I think Irma earlier, she needed interpretation, and Bernice, does she also need interpretation?
I don't need the interpretation.
Okay. Why don't we go to Irma?
Irma, puedes empezar tú presentándote, por favor, y puedes leer todo lo que tienes.
¿Quién? ¿Yo?
Irma.
Oh,
Irma. Irma Vázquez.
Bernice, why don't you do your testimony and then we'll...
Back to Irma.
Well, state your name for the tape and then proceed. Please.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Berenice, and I live in the central Minnesota area. I am a member of Health and Justice, and I want to tell you that I came to Minnesota with many dreams. My first dream was to meet my family. When I arrived, I only thought about working. I was 14 years old, and I started working 12 hours a day. 6 days a week. They gave me 1 day, 3 days a week training, and then I start milking cows. I didn't imagine the work was this heavy. My arms ache a lot from working long hours a day and 6 days a week. When we workers got sick, we couldn't rest. We just took pills for the pain and keep working. The workers go to work sick because we don't have benefits and we don't have a workers union. The salary is very low. I don't want to live like this all the time. The United States benefits from our work because we are hardworking people. Now I ask the Minnesota representatives to include agricultural workers and meat packers, childcare workers, and food packers in the distribution of the money that has been approved. Thank you. That's my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Juarez. Ms. Chevy, is Irma ready to go then?
Let me ask her. Irma, ¿ya estás lista? I can read his testimony. I have here in front of me in English.
Okay.
It's okay for you.
Okay. Do you want to identify yourself and say who you're reading the testimony for?
Yeah, my name is Maria Hernandez, and I read the testimony for Irma Velasquez. Okay. I am Irma Velasquez, and I'm here to ask you to support House File 2900. I'm a member of Unidos Minnesota, and an essential worker in the meatpacking industry. I have been working in the meatpacking for the following years. This is how I can provide for myself and my family. I don't mind doing this job, but I know this job is not to everyone, because it's so hard. They hurt your joints, bones, and whole body. I always know what is was doing was important for us, but I never really understood until the pandemic. It shocked me that before the pandemic, our work was low skill level. But during the pandemic, we were seen essential, but not essential are we. I am grateful for all the people who risked his lives day by day out to do work to call be done from home. I'm grateful that I was able to work in this time. But I also want to take the time to remember these who lost their lives by COVID. We miss them, but we are sure the families miss them more. I am still here to ask you to remember us, to remember you and the call staying home. I'm here to tell you the essential work style is a start, but this list back and up included all essential workers' pay and asking you to include the spouses or those who can testify because they died and left us too soon. We here and they are here with the spirit. So included me, include all the meat packets employers and all essential workers. Remember us when you go home and need tonight, every night. Essential workers deserve every essential pay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hernandez. And thank you, Ms. Velasquez is what I've got written down as, but thank you. The next person on my list is Ms. Sheevy. Did we ever get a hold of Marbella?
Marbella, ¿estás ahí? She has not connected, so I could actually read her testimony as well as Maria did.
Why don't you go ahead, identify yourself for the record and tell us who you're reading it for. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. My name is Taylor Chevy, and I am reading on behalf of Marbella Villanueva. Her testimony is as follows. My name is Marbella, member of CETUL. I work in downtown Minneapolis in the food industry. I am an essential worker. During the pandemic, it has been very difficult for me to have to work and go to work. I take risks, even though I am living with my elderly parents who are more vulnerable than I am to COVID. I went through a pregnancy and gave birth last summer. I went to work pregnant because I needed to provide for my family. Now I'm only scheduled to work a few hours each day, and the nanny charges me a lot of money for that time that I'm away. Before the pandemic, I had more hours. And so for our sacrifices and for our work, it is even more important that we are recognized and compensated for our efforts, since we are still out here working in person so that people have a place to buy food. Workers, we are the ones who move the economy. please include us in this essential worker pay and pass this bill for all essential workers. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chivy, and thank you, Marbella. The next person I have on my list, and I've only got two people left on my list, it's Alyssa Engel.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Alyssa Engel. I am a leader with Kids Count on Us, and I am currently working as a childcare teacher in Dilworth. I'm here to advocate for frontline worker payments of $1,500 to every essential worker, including childcare workers and others who are required to report to work at the height of the pandemic. Throughout the pandemic, childcare has been the glue that kept our state functioning. In fact, it has been the backbone of our modern society, allowing parents to participate in the workforce. During the pandemic, which is still ongoing, we were required to remain open to care for children of other essential workers, such as nurses and doctors, so their parents could be on the front lines. In June, my center was granted money from the state, which my boss graciously distributed to all of us employees. I received $150. Since the beginning of the pandemic, I have received no raises for hazard pay and no time off. $150 went down the drain fast. I spent several dollars on my own masks and prepared to take unpaid time off work if I felt ill after being vaccinated. Most of our children are too young to get vaccinated, and parents are exhausted from quarantining their children every other week. Since the beginning of the pandemic, I have been exposed to COVID over a dozen times just from the kids I care for. As our communities become fatigued with masks and mandates, they dump their illnesses on childcare workers. COVID has run rampant through our center, sending teachers into quarantine in droves. We're exhausted, we're sick, we're underpaid, and we're essential. $1,500 could be worth two paychecks for a childcare worker, and we've earned it. Childcare teachers, even those with higher education, rarely earn more than $15 an hour. Ironically, many childcare teachers need financial assistance to put their own children in daycare. We've been underpaid since long before the pandemic, and somehow our struggles are still being neglected in our communities. Some legislators want to reserve funding for healthcare workers to give them a bigger check. I say healthcare wouldn't survive without childcare. How can our healthcare workers be on the front lines if there is no one to care for their children? It's past time to acknowledge childcare's role in getting us through this pandemic, and it's well past time we were compensated for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Engel. The last person I have on my list is Tammy Green. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Is Tammy here? I don't see her name on our list. With that, members, I have one hand up for a question. Representative Mason, you have a question, then we'll go to the two amendments that we have. Representative Mason.
Okay, basically it's a comment, so do you want me to do that now or after?
Why don't you do it now, and then we'll get to the amendments.
Right. Mainly, it's to thank all of our testifiers. I mean, they're sharing their experiences and their stories. I mean, it's incredible to listen to, and I do want to appreciate everything that you're doing. And I truly wish that we could publicize some of these testimonies, especially when we have people that think that COVID is all over and want us to end everything. I mean, it's so hard to know what these people are going through and yet know that there is more, and there are so many people that are really not taking COVID seriously. End of commentary. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mason. With that, I've got two amendments. Representative Kosnick, you've got an A2 amendment. Representative Kosnick, you want to explain what your amendment does?
And move. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My copy of the amendment does not have the A2, but by deduction, I can figure it out. I want to also thank those who worked on this bill and came to testify. And obviously, probably does bear repeating, that COVID's been hard on everybody. It's been a challenging time in the legislature, been a challenging time in our families and our communities. And at the onset of COVID, we heard the mantra that we're all in this together. And so what the A2 amendment.
Do you got the A2 or the A3? I'm just looking here. I've got in my list here that was posted. Oh, there's the A2. Okay. Limits liability COVID. Is that the one you've got?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to move that amendment, Ben?
Sure. I move the A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And could you please describe what it does?
Right. As I was saying, COVID's been difficult on our families and our communities in all aspects of the economy and community. And at the beginning of COVID, we heard the mantra that we're all in this together. I think the legislature did a good job of coming together and initially managing what we knew and about COVID and what we didn't know about COVID. But what this amendment does is also kind of codifies and lives up to that we are all in this together, and nobody asked for COVID and nobody tried to profit off COVID and nobody really benefited off of it. But as we're looking at providing compensation for certain workers, I think it's also important to provide some liability to those that continue to move our economy, whether it's our churches, our schools, our nonprofits, or for-profits, and those that tried to follow the guidelines without any neglect or negligence, and provide us from becoming suing each other for COVID protocols as they were followed the best they could. And so that's essentially what the amendment does. I think it's an important factor in this whole discussion. And I did reach out to the author. We were not able to connect over the weekend, but I did send him my phone number to discuss these. So I hope they take this as a friendly amendment that will help you ensure success of your bill. Thank you.
Representative Fraser, what is your pleasure with the amendment? And
thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, Rep. Kosnick. Yeah, and I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to connect. I did get your email, and I was hoping I'd get to you, but I didn't. So I apologize, and I appreciate you reaching out prior to submitting the amendment. With that said, I do think this is probably something that should be addressed or discussed in the Judiciary Committee, which this bill is going to. So with that being said, I will say this, though. I don't think that at a moment when we're talking about taking care of frontline workers, and we just heard of all of these testimonies in front of us and what they went through, what some suffered through, and the cost some paid with their life for the work that they did during the pandemic. I don't think that this is an appropriate moment to talk about. I think you said we should provide liability, but I think you meant protection and immunity from liability for particular entities. Now, if there was no neglect, there won't be liabilities, but I don't think this is a moment to talk about protection from liability for possible neglect of workers at a time when we're trying to honor the workers that put their lives on the line to move all Minnesota forward. So I would urge a no vote on accepting this amendment.
Representative Kosnick, final word.
Well, I appreciate Mr. Chair allowing us to offer the amendment and discuss this. I think this is an important policy item that we should discuss as a legislature. I think there's relevance here to this bill specifically, we'll continue to discuss it. But so thank you, Mr. Chair, and I encourage our members to vote yes.
So all the members will unmute. All in favor of the A2.
Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call before you do that, if you wouldn't mind.
A roll call being requested. Mr. Brinks, would you please take the roll?
Yes. Chair Nelson.
No.
Chair Nelson votes no. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, no.
Carlson votes no. Representative Nash.
Nash, yes.
Nash votes yes. Representative Bonner. Representative Joskowski.
Aye.
Joskowski votes yes. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, no.
Elkins votes no. Representative Greenman.
No.
Representative Greenman votes no. Representative Cleavorn.
No.
Representative Cleburne votes no. Representative Tosnick.
Tosnick votes yes.
Tosnick votes yes. Representative Mason.
Mason, no.
Mason votes no. Representative New Brindley.
Yes.
Representative New Brindley votes yes. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, no.
Pawlowski votes no. Representative Quam.
C.
Quam votes yes. Representative Bonner.
My answer was no.
We didn't hear you the first time, Representative Bonner. Thank you.
With a vote of 5 yeses and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. The next amendment I have listed is A3, and it's also listed for Representative Kosnick. Is that also your amendment, Representative Kosnick?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
And you want to move the amendment and then describe what the amendment does.
Mr. Chair, I move the A3 amendment.
A3 has been moved. Representative Kosnick, what does this do?
This amendment actually extends the application period for workers applying to receive any frontline worker pay. And then it also deletes the second application period, as I think it would probably be not necessary and just makes it more cumbersome and more complicated to the public. And then also, the state has federal COVID relief dollars that were intended to help states through the variety of COVID measures, and uses the state fiscal recovery fund, also known as the American Rescue Plan funds for this rather than general fund dollars. That is the gist of my amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Representative Frazier, what is your pleasure with the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kosnick, for bringing this one again. Sorry we didn't get a chance to connect on this. I am actually intrigued by some of the issues that you raised or adjustments that you raised in this particular bill. And I want to take these under consideration. I'm going to be connecting with DALI, the department that will be administering these resources, and we'll be walking through them. But at this time, I'm going to urge a vote no, but I will be taking some of these in consideration because I think they're good ideas.
With that, we'll take a vote unless someone wants to do a roll call again, or if not, members unmute. All in favor of the
Kosnick. Mr. Chair, I would request a roll call. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's why I'm going slow. Anyway, roll call has been asked for. Mr. Brinks, can you please take the roll?
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
No.
Chair Nelson votes no. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, no.
Carlson votes no. Representative Nash.
Nash, yes.
Nash votes yes. Representative Bonner.
Bonner votes no.
Bonner votes no. Representative Joskowski.
Aye.
Joskowski votes yes. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, no.
Elkins votes no. Representative Greenman.
No.
Greenman votes no. Representative Cleburne.
No.
Cleburne votes no. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick votes yes.
Kosnick votes yes. Representative Mason.
Mason votes no.
Mason votes no. Representative New Brindley?
Yes.
New Brindley votes yes. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, no.
Pawlowski votes no. Representative Quam?
Aye.
Quam votes yes. With a vote of 5 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. With that, members, any questions or comments on the bill? Any questions on the bill? Representative Kosnick. You're muted, sir. There you go.
Yeah, no, my mouse was not being accurate enough on the mute button. I would appreciate a little bit of discussion with the author of maybe how the bill came to be to this final stage. I know that there was a work group in the summer. Maybe we should have had this discussion before the amendments, but that's fine. I kind of knew how the votes would go anyways, but it might be helpful to give us a genesis of where the bill and the work group and then how it came to be, some of the particular mechanics of the bill. I would be interested in understanding.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kozik, thank you for the, could you be more specific? And I could address those. I don't want to draw on. I know that we have another bill that needs to be heard.
Yeah.
Representative Kozik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could address, the 45-day application period ending and then setting up a second application period, it seemed to me a little complicated. Obviously, that's why I introduced offered the one amendment. It just seems more complicated and not very efficient to me. I think just a one application period would be sufficient. Maybe I'm missing something, Representative Frazier, if you could discuss that.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kozik. Thank you for that specific question. Yeah, I mean, that's why I said on that amendment that I do think there are some good ideas in there. That's one I think we want to take a look at. Initially, the initial appropriation or the initial agreement that we had was for $250 million. As you know, the work group stalemated on that and did not get the resources out because there was your colleagues wanted to exclude over hundreds of thousands of workers from these resources. Obviously, we do not agree with that. This bill captures and includes those hundreds of thousands of workers that would have been excluded. Many of them were the ones that were testifying today, and you agree, we all agree that those stories are touching and these workers deserve to be honored. Taking that into effect, with the initial $250 million, there was an idea that there may be a second round to ensure that if there was other resources, we could allocate more money. If depending on who applied in the initial rounds, if all the money wasn't spent, it would allow for higher payments for other folks to apply or to include a broader range of essential workers. That was the reason for that. So I think with this larger resources that we're asking for now and the identification of the over 700,000 workers that may be eligible, we can take a look at maybe not having that second round. But that is something I need to discuss with the department of heads and that are going to be administering this the resources.
Representative Kozik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Frazier. My other question was, how did we determine to use general fund dollars as opposed to federal dollars that were allocated to the state?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way we have a design, we could go with this would be allowed to use general funds or federal funds, but I know that there's a lot of discussions around where those federal funds are going to go. Wanted to make sure and ensure that the resources are going to be there for these workers. And just to notate, underscore, bold, highlight the fact that we have the surplus because of our workers.
Representative Kozik.
Thank you. That's all of my questions for now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Quam, I see your hand up.
Mr. Chair, and I was hoping to get some clarity on a few different things. To me, I sort of see a difference between frontline and essential and degree of frontline. And I was wondering if there was any consideration of tiering by the author and what those are.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam, could you be a little bit more specific about what do you mean about if there was this thoughts of tiering?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, all of the essential jobs did not have the same degree of intense interaction with people that had COVID, people with illnesses. I'll give an example. In Greater Minnesota, we've got a fire department. We also have first responder squads. And these are made up of EMTs, doctors, and others that have joined an organization so that they get paged out any time of the day. I remember my wife, the pager would go off 2 a.m, and she was out the door in less than 60 seconds and was down to the, get the rig and take it out, because minutes count. Now, I had quite a few interactions with different squads about PPE and other issues that they encountered, because they're going into vehicle accident sites, people's homes. Sometimes it's just a lift assist. Other times It's for, I mean, my wife delivered a baby one time. I mean, it's the whole spectrum. And, you know, we didn't have rapid COVID tests and the other available. You went out there and you took care of stuff, and there was probably a little bit more risk of exposure than if you were stocking shelves. So that way I see difference between, you know, essential and frontline and very frontline. And I'm trying to better understand the mechanisms that went into this bill and possible considerations for tiers of exposure and thus in the discussion of tiers of compensation.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kwan, for that detail. No, yeah, what the way we saw this was if you were working outside of your home, you're working in person, and you had the potential of being exposed to someone who may have contracted COVID-19, you were putting yourself at risk. All of these essential workers were putting themselves at risk. When we saw the massive breakout in meat processing plants, those folks were there and they contracted COVID-19 because of the space they were working in. Early on in this process, we didn't know much about COVID-19. We didn't provide much PPE. There are still some frontline workers working without adequate PPE, still putting themselves at risk and their families at risk every day. So no, didn't think of a tiered way to say that, you know, because you were working this certain job, even though you're exposing yourself on a day in and day out basis and possibly bringing it home to your family to possibly expose them and to possibly harm them and cause them death, that we're going to pay you less because of that. We did not see it that way.
Representative Kwan, one more question, if you have it, and let's move on.
Certainly. So I'm trying to also understand, again, in greater Minnesota, in fact, I think as a whole, the number of firefighters that are part of quote-unquote volunteer squads, I think outnumbers the actual, you know, city and you know, full-time firefighters. And these... they're called volunteer squads, but they're more than that. They're organizations that get funded through the townships and cities and towns that they work with. But the volunteer ambulance services, which they have in Dodge County, and I've got relatives that have participated in that. And then these first responder EMT squads, who don't show up as being a regular employee for the city, the county, et cetera. But there is some compensation. Are they qualified? And they were definitely frontline, high risk encounters. Are they in your bill included?
Representative Frazier.
They qualify, yes.
Thank you, Representative Kwan. Representative Greenman and members, we're going to vote on this at 5:45. We have one more bill we need to finish up tonight. We have to be done by 6. So, Representative Greenman and then Representative New Brindley. And then we're going to go to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Frazier. And more importantly, and I wanted to thank the workers who are on this call and the folks that we know that you represent. I've heard this bill now 3 times this year, but we also heard this bill last year when we were talking about the need to ensure that we are honoring and compensating our frontline workers. And I think that the urgency is real and the urgency is a year old. And so I know that, like, we are listening to your stories. And also, I know you shouldn't have to keep coming back. We've heard it over the summer. We've heard it in committee after committee. And so just really appreciate you sharing this story. You're feeding our kids. You're feeding us. You're taking care of our buildings. You're taking care of folks in our hospitals and our clinics. And you have better things to be doing, frankly, than continuing to have to remind us of your experiences. But I am so grateful that you do. And I hope that we are all working to lift up your voices and get this done, because it is, you all have helped us navigate this pandemic. And I just wanted to express gratitude and urgency. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And your question there, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually did serve on the frontline working group. And so I thought I would offer a few comments about the bill. As it turns out, I will not be given enough time to ask questions on the bill, but I will at least make a few comments then. For starters, I want to thank Representative Frazier and acknowledge that there are several pieces of the bill that actually we all agreed upon. And that's good. We're seeing that in the bill now. For example, the application process itself, we had a really good and interesting presentation from the state of Louisiana. They did this as well. And I think we all agreed that that general model was a good one. So that's something that we agreed on. We also all agreed on sort of having a defined period of time and a relatively short window for an application process so that it could be dealt with promptly. So that also had pretty broad agreements. Also, you'll notice in the bill that the payments are not to be considered income. And we all agreed that certainly we did not want these payments to affect other benefits that folks might be receiving, especially because this is obviously a short-term benefit, a one-time payment, and we certainly did not want some of those other benefits to be affected by this. So those are all pieces of this that we did agree on, which I think was good, and I think that we would still agree on those things. There are certainly a lot of things in this bill language that are concerning. And I'll just start. I will acknowledge Representative Quam. I appreciate your last question about the potential of a tiered approach. And in fact, our Democrat colleagues did offer a tiered approach when we were meeting in the working group this summer. So that certainly was considered by our Democrat colleagues. And in part, I think that was because we did believe that our frontline healthcare workers, as you have sort of indicated, were assuming a different level of risk. And we did focus on that. Despite what one of our Democrat colleagues said in committee, that they were all working under, quote, the exact same circumstances, we actually don't think that's true. And we know that there were nurses and healthcare providers going to work every single day who absolutely knew that they were coming in contact with COVID. It wasn't a question. It wasn't a potential risk. It was absolutely a defined risk, and they were going to work in spite of it. And I think that's a really critical piece of this and a really critical piece of our desire to focus on those frontline healthcare workers who were dealing with this every day. Since there are only 3 minutes, I will just hit a few things, a few points of concern. One, you know, we chose not to have income caps. And the reason for that is that some of the people that will be excluded from this bill are exactly those people who are working directly with COVID positive patients day in and day out. Frankly, fortunately for them, you know, we've got nurses who are very skilled in what they do. And because of that, they're reasonably well paid. And yet they certainly were assuming arguably the greatest amount of risk about the pandemic. And this will exclude some of those nurses who were assuming the greatest risk. The other thing that I would say is there are a lot of pieces to this bill that are not well defined. For example, in line 3.22, it talks about a timely fashion that an applicant's eligibility must be verified in a timely fashion. And if the commissioner doesn't verify it in a timely fashion, then they just have to accept the self-certification. Well, that's an awful lot of discretion for a commissioner to have with no actual requirement is what that means. That's really what it comes down to. The requirement may as well not even be there if we're not going to have a way to ensure that that's actually happening. Another point that I'm particularly concerned about under the notice requirement on line 4.23 and 4.24, it says that it must be the notice must be given, quote, in a form approved by the Commissioner of Labor and Industry And then just a couple lines later, it said that the notice must be given using the same means that the employer uses to provide other work-related notices to employees. So I guess I would say, well, which is it? There are two things listed there. We should probably figure that out. I will hop down. I don't know why Subdivision 10 would be in there, exempting the commissioners from our procurement processes in the state. Those procurement processes are in place to protect taxpayer dollars. And honestly, we've seen
Representative Green, if you want to wrap up here, we're getting close to the time.
You're taking my time, Mr. Chair. Honestly, this is how we end up with shady sweetheart deals to our friends by eliminating a procurement process. That's especially concerning. And then if we had time, I would certainly ask questions about the $756,000 in a general fund for grants to the Minnesota Training Partnership. I am guessing, by the language as I read it, these grants are given to help people to publicize the availability of the grants. However, the way I read this, those grants can't go to businesses. They're going to all these other organizations. Again, this is where we end up with, paying off our friends and not actually taking care of business. And the problem here is that we're giving $756,000 to whoever to publicize this, but it is not going to employers who are required to publicize this. And not only that, we're giving $750,000 to groups to publicize this who have no liability whatsoever. And then on the flip side, we are requiring employers to publicize this under penalty of $1,000 per employee if they do not publicize this correctly. And of course, as we already said, it's going to be up to the commissioners to determine how they publicize it. This is all going to move very quickly. And so this
creates an enormous amount of liability for employees, and none of the help
to get that word out like it's given to everyone else.
Mr. Chair, if I may, all of these questions will be answered, and none of it is as she's suggesting. This is all misrepresentation of this bill. I'm sorry.
Well, if the chair were to give appropriate time to be able to ask the questions, we could certainly get them answered, but that's not the case. To also, there's $75,000 going to administrative
Representative Brindley, we're going to go to a vote.
And there's almost $5 million overall.
Representative Brindley, I'm going to mute you because we're going to a vote.
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to lay this bill on the table. There has not been sufficient time to even ask questions from our members. And that is something that's
outrageous. The administrative costs.
I would request a roll call on the motion to lay this on the table.
Motion's been made to lay this on the table. The roll call has been taken. Mr. Brinks, please take the roll.
Chair Nelson.
No.
Chair Nelson votes no. Vice Chair Carlson.
No.
Carlson votes no. Representative Nash.
Nash, yes.
Nash votes yes. Representative Bonner.
Bonner votes no.
Bonner votes no. Representative Joskowski.
Aye.
Representative Joskowski votes aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins votes no.
Elkins votes no. Representative Greenman.
No.
Greenman votes no. Representative Cleborn.
Cleborn, no.
Cleborn votes no. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick votes aye.
Kosnick votes aye. Representative Mason.
Mason, no.
Mason votes no. Representative New Brindley.
Yes.
New Brindley votes yes. Representative Pawlowski. Representative Quam.
Yes.
Quam votes yes. Representative Pawlowski. With that, the vote is 5 no's to 7 yeses. The motion does not prevail. Or, I apologize, excuse me. 5 yeses to 7 no's. The motion does not prevail.
Mr. Chair.
The motion does not prevail. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, I try to work very closely with you to make sure that we do things in an orderly process, but not allowing my members to ask questions by allowing tons of testifiers to fill up the majority of time, and that's fine. But this is a big bill, it's an important bill, and the voice of the minority is important. And I have been told that countless times when you were in the minority, when I first came in. This is not something that I think is particularly fair to my side of the aisle, particularly somebody who was on that commission. Representative New Brindley was there for every single meeting and knows this probably better than anybody else. And yet we can't find times to give her a sufficient allowance to ask questions. Again, Mr. Chair, I don't want to have a bumpy landing, but we're actually heading into a bumpy takeoff, which can only lead to a bumpy landing.
Representative Nash, thank you for that. With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 2900 be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Mr. Brinks, please take the roll.
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Chair Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
Nash, no.
Nash votes nay. Representative Bonner.
Bonner votes aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Drazkowski votes nay. Representative Elkins.
Elkins votes aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Greenman aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn aye.
Cleavorn votes aye. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick no.
Kosnick votes nay. Representative Mason.
Mason aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley.
No.
New Brindley votes nay. Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski aye.
Pulaski votes aye. Representative Quam.
No.
Quam votes nay. With 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails.
Motion prevails. The bill is on its way to taxes. Next bill we have, and we've got 9 minutes to get it to work on this, and we have to move this to another meeting also. But House File 3024, and we laid this on the table the last meeting that we ran out of time. We have an amendment to the bill, Representative Bolden. And the amendment is to insert the appropriation of the bill because the bill has a fiscal cost. I will move the A1 amendment, Representative Bolden. What's your pleasure with the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would ask support for this amendment. It simply is allocating that appropriation and would encourage support. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Could we have the author of the amendment and the ultimate fiscal note walk through what that fiscal note says and give us all some further illumination on that?
I'm the author of the amendment because because the bill didn't have a fiscal appropriation in it. Ms. Roberts, if you want to walk through the fiscal note. Ms. Roberts, we go.
Okay. Sorry about that. Yes, Mr. Chair and members. The fiscal note shows costs to the Secretary of State's office, and those are for computer programming, costs to the state voter registration system. So those are the $184,000 that you see in the 23 appropriation, and then there are ongoing costs as well of $37,000 per year for maintenance of that system. In addition, the Secretary of State's office would have some rulemaking costs, but they are absorbing those costs.
Representative Nash.
Nothing further.
If everybody wants to unmute, all those in favor of the A1 amendment to put the appropriations into the bill, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
The ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. Members, we had plenty of time on this the other night or the other afternoon, well, almost an hour's worth of testimony on this bill and questions back and forth. And so, members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3024 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And Mr. Brinks, would you please take the roll?
There is a hand up, Mr. Chair.
We're in the middle of a vote. Mr. Brinks, would you please take the roll?
My hand was up before the vote was called for.
Mr. Brain. Chair, is this how we want to do this?
Chair Nelson.
Aye.
Chair Nelson votes aye. Vice Chair Carlson.
Carlson aye.
Carlson votes aye. Representative Nash.
No.
Nash votes nay. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner votes aye. Representative Drazkowski.
No.
Drazkowski votes nay. Representative Elkins.
Elkins aye.
Elkins votes aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman votes aye. Representative Cleburne. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick, no.
Kosnick votes no. Representative Mason.
Mason, aye.
Mason votes aye. Representative New Brindley.
No.
Representative New Brindley votes no. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski votes aye. Representative Quam.
Yet, comrade.
Quam votes nay. Representative Cleburne.
Cleburne votes aye.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. With 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails.
The motion prevails. The bill is on its way to Ways and Means. And members, we have a meeting tomorrow morning. And we have, again, we have bills up, and we've got a time scheduled the evening for the bills we don't get to. So members, we will recess tomorrow morning at 10 and reconvene after 6 p.m. To take up the remainder with bills. And with that, members, we are adjourned.
Representative. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to go on record again. I was watching the hands. Representative New Brindley's hand was up prior to you actually instituting the call for the roll call vote. Once again, this is all we have. So we can either make the most of it and have you work to make sure that our people can actually get questions in. We had time. We still have time. We could have done the vote and still been out of here on time. But Representative New Brindley had her hand up. You chose to walk past it. You know, I tried to set a tone this morning with an apology for something last week. But if this is how we're going to go about this, I think that this is going to be a very long session, and we can offer as many amendments as you'd like to drag things out until the wee hours of the night, because that's how, I guess, is the only way we're going to get our voices across unless you allow us to have discussion. So I would appreciate you addressing my concern right there.
Well, Mr. Representative Nash, as I said earlier, we wanted to vote on that other bill at 4:45 so that we could get it, or 5:45, excuse me, so we could get this bill. Representative New Brindley blew through that. It wasn't until 5:48 that she stopped talking, and I had to interrupt her to go to the vote. So, Mr. Representative Nash, I'm trying
to
be... Mr.
Chair, you called on me at 5:38.
Representative New Brindley, I'm speaking with Representative Nash. I have the floor. Representative Nash, that is why we took to the vote. Like I said, I said at the beginning we wanted to get that vote on this at 5:45. And like I said, we can talk forever, and I know we're all good at that. But members, we should have some courtesy for the people that are presenting the bills. And I also prefer that we don't have 14 testifiers. I wasn't the one that set that up. And I'll have a discussion with Representative Frazier on that. But with that, members, we are adjourned.